of the country can go bankrupt or lose their homes or die because they don't have coverage or they get their policies canceled.
That's Wendell Potter, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Wendell Potter on health insurance, an insane system. The murder of UnitedHealthcare CEO on a Midtown Manhattan street unleashed, the New York Times reported, a torrent of morbid glee from patients and others who say they have had negative experiences with health insurance companies at some of the hardest times of their lives. Some of the comments were thoughts and deductibles to the family. Another one said, unfortunately, my condolences are out of network. The dark commentary highlighted deep anger over the state of health insurance. Millions simply can't afford it and go without. And many who are on some plan have such inadequate coverage and high deductibles that they can't afford to pay for anything. The answer, Ralph Nader says, is single payer. Everybody in, nobody out. That would bring down prices, but the handful of corporations who monopolize the health insurance industry don't want that. Why? That would cut into their profits. So the insanity continues. Our guest today is Wendell Potter. He was a former Cigna public relations executive, and today he's an outspoken critic of the health insurance industry. This classic from the AR archives is even more relevant today than it was when it was originally recorded over a decade ago. Wendell Potter spoke at Powell's Bookstore in Portland, Oregon.
I think I'll begin by just answering a question that I'm often asked when I am speaking to groups, and that is, why did you do what you did? Why don't more people do what you did? And what led you to do what you decided to do? There was no one thing that led me to do this. It was a culmination of a number of things. I had a wonderful career in the health insurance industry. I've actually had two careers. I was a journalist, and I had a very good career as a journalist. I was a reporter initially in Memphis and Nashville, and then finally in Washington, and I covered Congress and the White House and the Supreme Court for a few years. But I decided to go into PR, first in a political campaign. I was a press secretary for a guy who ran for governor of Tennessee. And from there, my PR career just meandered, and it took me from one place to another, and I eventually wound up working for a big for-profit health insurance company, Humana, based in Louisville, Kentucky. At that time, Humana was largely known as a hospital company, and I was hired to help promote and defend and be a spokesperson for the hospitals that the company owned. After doing that for 4 years, I was recruited to Hartford, Connecticut, to support Cigna's healthcare operations. Cigna at that time was a very large multi-line insurance company. It had property and casualty division, a financial services division, and a reinsurance division, and I was hired to help raise the awareness of Cigna as a health insurance company. Insurers were beginning to catch on to the fact that a lot of money could be made in health insurance. When I worked at Humana, Humana decided to get rid of its hospitals because the executives and shareholders thought that they could make more money if they focused on managed care and health insurance. So they spun the hospitals off to a different company and focused on managed care. And I became the chief spokesperson for Humana and was doing that when I was recruited to Cigna. And Cigna likewise saw that there was a lot of money to be made in health insurance and got rid of its property and casualty division and the other divisions that shareholders felt were not as profitable as health insurance could be. So Aetna did the same thing. Aetna's mix of businesses was very similar to Cigna's during that time, and Aetna did exactly the same thing. It got rid of those other divisions so it could focus on making money on health insurance. When I joined those companies, I thought that managed care was truly a good way to provide finance health care in this country, and I still think that as a concept it's not bad. We have some still very good, I think, solid and reputable players in the managed care space. Some people might disagree, but I think the Kaiser model is one that has worked pretty well for a lot of people, and here in the Pacific Northwest and some other parts of the country, like the northeastern states, where primarily there have been nonprofit organizations that have provided health insurance. What really happened was back about the time that I was working for Humana. Both Humana and Cigna, by the way, are for-profit companies, as you probably know. They're two of seven very large for-profit companies that now dominate the health insurance industry, and I work for two of them. Now, one out of every three Americans is enrolled, if you're insured, in some kind of a benefit plan sponsored by or offered by one of these seven big companies. The for-profit companies began to dominate in the years following the collapse or the failure of the Clinton health care plan. And we saw the conversion of a lot of nonprofit Blue Cross plans to for-profit status. And we saw a consolidation in the industry. And now we have a lot of the Blue Cross plans around the country are owned by this big, gigantic company called WellPoint. So we've seen enormous change in the industry. My point is that initially the concept of managed care was, again, something that worked pretty well for a lot of folks. But when these companies saw that they could make a lot of money on managed care, that's when things started getting, our healthcare system took a turn for the significantly for the worse. One of the things that led me to finally decide that I was not in the right business, I was growing increasingly uncomfortable being a spokesman for an industry that was pushing more and more of us into so-called consumer-driven plans. You may have heard the term, but it's a kind of a euphemism for plans that have very high deductibles. And what they are doing is pushing more and more of us into these kinds of plans that require us to pay a lot more money out of our own pockets for care, even if we have insurance. We're paying premiums every month, often as much as we have in the past, but we're getting far less value for it. Often they shrink the benefits or they eliminate benefits, and they make us pay a lot more out of our own pockets. WellPoint has a plan in Maine that is requiring people to pay $30,000 out of their pockets before the insurance will pay a dime. That is the trend, and I was growing increasingly uncomfortable being a spokesman for these kinds of plans. They're extremely profitable for health insurance companies, and that is one reason why these companies have recorded record profits. When I was working for Cigna for 10 years, I handled financial communications. I was the person who explained to reporters who called every time the company announced earnings how the company made its money and whether or not it met Wall Street's expectations. That is the most important thing to these companies, is whether or not you're going to meet Wall Street's expectations for profit. And if you don't, your stock price will go down. And when that happens, if you're an executive, so will your stock options. And you do not want that to happen. So the first priority is always to meet Wall Street's expectations. You're financially invested in this. And the CEOs, for example, at Cigna, the CEO, 90% of his salary is at what they call at risk. And it's determined on whether or not the company performs to Wall Street's satisfaction. And if he doesn't, he doesn't get as much. But if he does, he makes an enormous amount of money, millions and millions of dollars every year. I was worried about these plans, and I did not believe, as I was having to say, that this was the new silver bullet to get more people covered and to provide adequate coverage. What I really was learning was that it is a primary reason why we now have not only 51 million people who are uninsured, we have at least half that many, if not more, 25 million, as estimated by the Commonwealth Fund, who are underinsured. They're paying premiums, but they have plans that are so inadequate that if they do get sick, they're going to be on the hook to pay so much out of their own pockets that people are still losing their jobs or filing bankruptcy, losing their homes because they simply cannot make the out-of-pocket expenses that's required of them. If you consider that the median household income in this country is still just roughly around $50,000, and the average cost of a family health insurance premium that is purchased through the workplace is about $13,500. If you're having to pay premiums and then a lot of money out of your own pocket, that's not very good value in my book. And but the other thing that I didn't really relish and didn't want to be a part of was helping to defeat health care reform. When I worked for Humana and then transitioned to Cigna, it was in 1993, and that was the year that the Clinton health care reform was being debated in Congress. And I played a significant role in helping to defeat that plan. My peers at other companies and I would meet in Washington on a regular basis to develop PR strategies to try to turn people away, to scare people into thinking that this the Clinton plan was a government takeover of the healthcare system, would lead to much higher taxes, would lead to people not having the kind of coverage that they had had in the past and that they valued. So it was a very successful fear-mongering campaign. Fear-mongering is at the core of a lot of these companies' PR strategies. They know that if they can scare people, they can scare them away from reform. And we saw that happening over the past year. And we saw it happening also during the campaigns that led up to the midterm elections. I didn't want to be a part of that again because I knew that we had to do something to try to reform our healthcare system because private insurance companies had not been able to do what they promised to do when the Clinton plan fell. When the Clinton plan fell, the private insurers were saying, give us a chance. Let the free market system help solve the problems in our healthcare system, and we can be there by bringing solutions to the table, to use the term that they've used. Unfortunately, what happened was just the opposite of bringing solutions to the table. It created even more problems. We've seen a steady growth in the number of people who are uninsured and a rapidly growing number of people who are underinsured. And we've seen benefits shrink, and we've seen that they have not been able to control medical inflation. So we've got a problem that is a healthcare system that's even in worse crisis than it was in 1993. But what the health insurance industry had to do was to convince people that the healthcare crisis was not that big of a deal after all, that millions of people still have insurance, they like their insurance, so let's not do anything that might cause people to lose their insurance. And they made people afraid that healthcare reform would result in their possibly losing the insurance that they have and that they value. They were very much involved in the disruption of town hall meetings when Democratic members of Congress were having the town hall meetings all across the country, and you may recall and may have even been to some of the town hall meetings at which people who had been persuaded to be opposed to health care reform came to these meetings to disrupt them, not to listen, not to ask questions, but to disrupt them. And a lot of insurance money, your premium dollars, by the way, have financed a lot of these disruptions. I spoke at one town hall meeting in New Jersey. It was sponsored by Congressman Bill Pascrell in central New Jersey. And he had invited me to speak because it was not too long after I had given my testimony before one of the House panels that he was on. And I was giving a talk sort of like this. I was trying to explain how big insurance companies have been so successful in past years in manipulating public opinion to influence public policy. That's the ultimate objective. It was hard to be heard over the chaos because the Tea Party folks were trying to drown out the speakers, and the folks who were there supporting health care reform were trying to show support for the speakers, so it was just chaos. Afterwards, a woman came up, and I could tell on which side she was on by the sign that she was carrying. It was health care reform, tort reform now, and tort reform is something that the health insurance industry and big business has led us to think is a cure-all for the problems of our healthcare system. It certainly is not. There are some things undoubtedly that probably could be done to improve the tort system and to help improve or address medical malpractice and things of that nature. But it's a diversionary tactic that the insurance industry and others have used to try to get the focus away from some of the real problems in our healthcare system that have been caused by the health insurance industry. But anyway, she was carrying this sign, and I knew that she had been persuaded to think in a certain way. And she said, "No one paid me to be here tonight." And I said, "Ma'am, I know that no one paid you to be here. You didn't get a dime. but a lot of money went into getting you here tonight, and a lot of your premium dollars in this audience and that audience, went into getting those people there to not only make them fearful of health care reform, but to be a part of the anger mongering. It's not just fear mongering, it's anger mongering, to get people so worked up, so angry at members of Congress that they will vote against their own self-interest, as we saw happen during the past midterm election. So I didn't want to be a part of that. I didn't want to be part of yet another effort to defeat reform. And I decided that I was going to leave before I had to be intimately involved in that and playing an active role in defeating reform this time. But this was in 2007, and there were a few things that happened in that particular year that really led me to know that I was not doing the right thing. I was not engaged in right livelihood. I am from East Tennessee, a very rural part of the state, and a very Republican, conservative part of the state, in the very northeastern part of Tennessee. I think every one of my relatives are Republicans, and that's just the way, and they still are. It's one of the most Republican areas in the country. I was back home visiting my folks, and I picked up the local newspaper. This was in June of 2007. July, and I read an article about a healthcare expedition that was being held across the state line. Kingsport, Tennessee, where I grew up, is just right on the border with Virginia, and this expedition was being held in Wise County, Virginia, which is a few miles up the road in the heart of the coal mining area of southwestern Virginia, very remote and quite poor. But it said that people would be driving to this expedition. From as far away as Ohio and Georgia and South Carolina, and that's a long drive to get to Wise County, Virginia, a very remote town in the southwestern part of the state. I was curious. I was wondering, why would people do this? And the paper said this was the eighth year it was being done, and that more people showed up every year than the year before. And it was being put on by this organization called Remote Area Medical that started in the 80s. It was started by a guy named Stan Brock. If you ever saw a TV show called Animal Kingdom, I think it was Animal Kingdom. He was one of the actors in that. When he left, he had spent a lot of his time in the Amazon area of South America, and he wanted to do something to help those folks. He became very much aware that people who lived in those remote villages did not have good access to care. So he organized this effort to fly doctors from the U.S. to the Amazon to give people care that they wouldn't have otherwise. And he did the same thing. He would eventually take them to countries in Africa. And he's taken a lot of doctors down to Haiti in recent years. But within a few years after starting this, he realized that the need was just as great, if not greater, in this country as some of the places where he was taking these doctors to the Amazon. So most of the expeditions they do in these days are in the United States, and it's not just in remote areas anymore. One of the biggest is now in Los Angeles. They've been doing it for 2 years, stretches over 8 days, and thousands of people come to get free care. One of the things I found out when I got there was that most of these folks work. They're not unemployed. They're not shirking their individual responsibility. They would like to have coverage, but for whatever reason, they can't have it. They work for small businesses that don't offer benefits, which is a growing trend in this country. Fewer than half of small businesses now offer health care benefits. A lot of those folks couldn't get insurance at any price because they had pre-existing conditions. In our healthcare system now, the way it's set up, insurance companies will not sell insurance policies to someone who's been sick in the past, and that's been perfectly legal. And I also knew from what I had done at Cigna, the insurance companies will actually dump the sick. They will cancel policies when people get sick. And then that's been perfectly legal as well, too. So a lot of these folks were in, for one reason or another, they did not have coverage. I did find out, though, that of those, there were a lot of people there who did have coverage, but many of them were in these kinds of plans I mentioned earlier, these plans with such high deductibles that they might as well not be covered. They couldn't afford to go to the doctor, and consequently, they stopped going They're getting sicker. A lot of folks don't pick up their medications that are prescribed for them. More and more don't have dental benefits or vision benefits. One of the greatest needs is in all of these expeditions is for dental care. People just can't afford to go to the dentist. And anyhow, when I borrowed my dad's car and drove up there and I walked through the fairground gates, it was more than I ever imagined. Yes, there were thousands of people who were there. And I found out that many of them had driven the night before and had spent the night in the parking lot of their cars or their pickup trucks, or they camped out, and it was raining. It was summer, but it was a kind of a cold rain that was falling in the mountains there. They had gotten up before dawn to stand in a very long line to get a number to be able to get inside the fairground gates. And once they were inside, they had to stand in long lines once again to get care that was being delivered. I saw when I got there that was being delivered in barns and animal stalls that other volunteers had come just days before to scrub down so that doctors could have somewhat of a sterile place to, if not sterile, at least somewhat clean, to provide the care that these people needed. It wasn't just blood pressure checks, folks. There were doctors there who were removing skin cancers, who were doing colonoscopies, who were mammographies, and you name it. They were doing all kinds of outpatient kinds of treatments, and I could tell that a lot of those folks undoubtedly were people that I could have grown up with in East Tennessee, and undoubtedly there were people from East Tennessee who were there. They could have been people that could have been neighbors of mine, if not relatives. And it was the first time that I had really come face to face with faces of real people who were part of that, what is now 51 million people without insurance. In my job at Cigna, I dealt in numbers, as I mentioned before. I explained how much money the company made and how much in revenues it took in. And I knew, of course, that at that time about 47 million people didn't have insurance. But it was just a number to me. When I got to Wise County, I could no longer just think of it as a number. Those faces haunted me. And I knew that the industry that I worked in was directly responsible in many ways for those people having to stand in long lines and waiting for to be served by doctors who were volunteering their times to provide that care at animal stalls and barns. I made a commitment to myself that day that I would soon find some other way to make a living. I didn't know what it would be, but I just knew I didn't want to do that very much longer. But it took me some time to process that. 2 weeks later, back at the job in Philadelphia, I had to go to a meeting in Connecticut, and I was going to be flying on the corporate jet, which I did often. And I was flying to Connecticut with the CEO. I'd done this many times. I'd flown not just to Connecticut, but to the West Coast many times and all over the country. And I paid more attention this time than I ever had before. And I noticed that on that short flight, we were served lunch by a flight attendant who was an employee of Cigna, paid, again, by your premium dollars. And we were served lunch on gold-rimmed china. And we were given gold-plated flatware to eat it with. And we were sitting in these luxurious leather chairs. And right all around us was polished mahogany and wood. If you get a chance to fly in a corporate jet, I'd do it because it's really the way to travel. It makes first class in a commercial flight seem like a cattle car. It was very hard to give that up, and I had taken that for granted that this was my life. This was something that I had earned. I had earned the ability to fly in a corporate jet to meetings. I was very well paid. It's hard to walk away from a job like that. But that day I thought, maybe because it had been so recently that I had been to Wise County, I realized that people's premium dollars were helping me to fly that way, and that because of the practices of the insurance industry, those folks in Wise County were having to wait in long lines to get care in animal stalls. it just came together for me at that time that this is what is going on in this country, and that the industry that I work for was more responsible for the intractable problems in our healthcare system than I think any other part of the healthcare system. It is largely since the industry's become dominated by, these seven large for-profit companies that have as their chief objective, the number one objective, is to meet Wall Street's expectations. And they do these things. They dump the sick just so they can make sure they don't have to pay the claims that might keep them from meeting Wall Street's expectations. There was a congressional hearing just before I gave my testimony in the Senate for the first time. This House committee was looking into the practice of rescissions of these companies going back to review a person's application after they've gotten sick. This is a practice in the individual insurance market. Because insurance companies can deny you coverage if you've been sick in the past, a lot of folks lie, or they intentionally leave things out. They can't get insurance otherwise. They know that. I met a guy in San Francisco last year, very wealthy guy. He was an investor. He'd been a serial entrepreneur. He found himself unable to buy insurance at any price because of this. He had been diagnosed with gout at one point in the past, and he had mentioned that on his application, and he could not get insurance for being treated for gout. So his wife, who didn't have to work, had to go back to work for a company that offered benefits so that they would have insurance coverage. It's just insane. We have the most insane system of health insurance on the planet. It became very clear to me that a lot of these practices were causing our problems. The story I was getting at, the point I was making, that this congressional hearing found that just looking at three of the big for-profit companies over 5 years, those three companies alone had rescinded or canceled 20,000 policies of very sick people. That's bad enough, but the reason they did was because they were able to save or avoid paying out more than $300 million in claims. So they look at the big ticket items. They look at the people who are the sickest to cancel their policies. And when that happens, can you imagine being this woman that I was who was testifying was notified in the midst of being treated for breast cancer that her company was canceling her insurance. And the reason they gave was that she had been treated for acne in the past, but she had not disclosed that. And they decided that she was not being honest in her application, and they gave them justification to cancel her policy, meaning that she was getting no help to pay her bills for her cancer care. She was all on her own. We're the only industrialized country, the only developed country that in which the citizens of the country can go bankrupt or lose their homes or die because they don't have coverage or they get their policies canceled. It has been a very common and prevalent practice.
You're listening to Wendell Potter on health insurance, an insane system. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online our website, alternativeradio.org.
I became aware of all of this toward the end of my career as I was going up the corporate ladder and learning more and more about how companies operated and what they did, the links they would go to meet Wall Street's expectations. The reason I did this, going back to what I said earlier, why did I leave? What was it other than these things that happened to me in 2007 and just my growing awareness of what these companies did? And I think it is because of where I came from. I came from that part of the world, and I was a journalist. And I think I came to realize toward the end of my career as a PR guy for the insurance industry that I was doing often the exact opposite of what I was doing as a reporter. And I took my job as a reporter very seriously. I wanted to genuinely tell the truth, to report fact, and to help people understand a situation or something that was happening in ways that would put it in context or perspective. And I tried to keep bias out of my stories because I was an objective reporter. What I realized that I was doing toward the end of my career was the exact opposite of that. I was trying to confuse people or to avoid telling the whole truth by using selective information or disclosing selective information or slicing and dicing data in certain ways to prove a point. And even worse, sometimes intentionally misleading people in some of these fear-mongering campaigns. I became very ashamed of what I was doing. I was not at all proud of what I was doing to earn a living. But the other thing I think that was even more important was because when I saw those folks in Wise County who could have been my neighbors, I remembered my own upbringing, and I can remember my mom in particular saying, "Don't ever forget where you came from." I wrote something about that in the book, and this is the part that I'm going to read. And it's really kind of a tribute to my parents. I was born in Banner Elk, North Carolina on July 16, 1951, not because my parents lived there, but because they didn't have access to affordable quality care in the tiny town where they did live, on the other side of the Blue Ridge Mountains, Mountain City, Tennessee. There was no hospital in Mountain City, or the entire county for that matter. My parents, Blaine and Pearl Potter, were born and raised in Johnson County. Mountain City is the county seat, one of the most beautiful places on earth, in my opinion, but where even today it is hard to make a living. There were only two doctors in all of Johnson County when I was born. My mother didn't want either of them to have anything to do with bringing me into this world. She had heard good things about the hospital in Banner Elk, so that's where Dad drove her, over 30 miles of winding, mountainous roads when she went into labor. Affordable quality health care wasn't the only thing my folks didn't have easy access to. Money was another. I've never met a smarter, harder working, and more resourceful man than my dad, but I probably earned more in 1 year at Cigna than he earned in 20, in the 20-some years that he worked in a brutally hot factory before he retired in 1980. Before his factory job, when I was born, he and Mom had a small farm. The main money crop was tobacco, and they ran a little country store called Potter's Grocery on Spear Branch Road outside of Mountain City. Dad built both the store and our first house next door to it with help from a couple of my uncles and cousins. Like most of the houses on Spear Branch Road at the time, ours did not have an indoor bathroom. We would not have one, in fact, until we moved when I was about six to what seemed to me to be a huge city, Kingsport, about 50 miles to the west. For more than a year before we moved to Kingsport, Dad commuted to the Blue Ridge Glass plant, where a relative had been able to get him a job while my mom stayed back and tended Potter's Grocery. Sometimes Dad was so tired after working a double shift that he would sleep in the back of his 1949 Willys Jeep wagon rather than risk driving exhausted all the way back home to Mountain City. I didn't see a lot of him during that time. And when Potter's Grocery became a money loser, they had to close the store and look for another way to support us. It seems that Mom and Dad had let their out-of-work customers, all of whom were neighbors and many of whom were relatives, run up tabs that they could never pay off. After that, we lived in a duplex close to the glass plant until Mom and Dad had saved enough money to make a down payment on a rundown house a few miles outside of town that Dad would spend months fixing up. Dad never knew much about his own father. One day when Dad was in the third grade, his father walked away and never came back, leaving my grandmother to raise nine children herself. They all had to get odd jobs to help put food on the table. When he was in his early 20s, my dad joined the Civilian Conservation Corps, a Great Depression era work program that was created during the Roosevelt years. The CCC put Dad on a train and sent him across the country to help build a public work projects a few miles north of here in Doty, Washington. He mailed almost everything he made back home to his mother in East Tennessee, as he did later when the Army sent him to Europe and North Africa during World War II. While Dad was overseas, Mom got a wartime job working on an assembly line at a chemical plant in Kingsport. They were married just days after Dad got back home. I didn't arrive for another 6 years. Neither of my parents was able to finish high school, having to work instead. They wanted nothing more than for me to have an easier life than they had had, and they knew I wouldn't have a chance unless I had a good education. they sacrificed years to save enough money to send me to college. I'll never be able to repay them or thank them enough. I became the first person in my family to earn a college degree when I graduated from the University of Tennessee in 1973. I read that just so you'd know a bit more about me and where I came from, and I honestly don't think that had it not been for my upbringing, had I not been there to visit them, had I not picked up the newspaper and read about those folks, I would probably not be here right now. I probably would still be telling lies for the insurance industry, or at least misleading people. But because of that, because of that experience and that reminder of where I came from, that's really why I did what I did, more than anything else. It was just honoring my parents, that I knew that as much money as I was making, I really had really succeeded. I had a life that was far, far easier than they had ever had. My work was not honorable work. So that's why I ultimately decided to leave. But at this point, let's just have a conversation.
Does the health care bill benefit the insurance companies? And can it lead to a single-payer system?
In the short term, it will guarantee a significant new profit stream for the insurance companies. The requirement that we all had to buy insurance was the thing that the insurance industry wanted most out of this legislation. It's ironic that the Republicans campaigned against it, and they campaigned on a repeal and replace platform, and targeted that in particular. The lobbyists from the health insurance industry that will come to their offices, and they'll have a kind of a come to Jesus kind of meeting, and they say, "Look, this is the way it's going to be. You can have your hearings all you want. That's fine. You can badmouth, you can complain about this legislation. You can repeal it if you want to over here in the House, but we know that it'll never pass in the Senate. And even if it does, the president would veto it. So we know it's not going to be repealed. Do what you need to do to satisfy the folks who you led to believe this should be repealed. You may owe them that, but keep in mind that we're the folks who really give you the contributions, and we will in the future if you do what we ask you to do. That's the way it works in Washington. So it's not going to be repealed. You'll see a lot of sand and fury. Now, is it a path for a potential single payer? I think it can be if this legislation is indeed implemented as it is supposed to be. These companies will not be able to make the profits they've made in the past. There are enough regulations and restrictions on them that those profit margins can be squeezed, and investors will not like that. And Wall Street rules, and if the investors say that this is not the best place for us to invest our money, they'll move it somewhere else. And these for-profit companies will decide that they can do something else and make more money, just as they have changed, as I described earlier. The reason I explain that is because I wanted you to understand that the health insurance industry has been in great evolution for the past several years, and it will continue to evolve. And this reform legislation will force some changes that otherwise wouldn't happen. Initially, the big for-profits will win. But ultimately, I think that their profit margins will be reduced, and their business models are not sustainable for the long haul. You cannot keep shifting more and more of the cost to consumers and expect the consumers to be able to put up with your product. Yes, ma'am.
Matt Taibbi says, as long as the insurance companies function as a cartel, we can't do anything about them. What do you think?
Well, and I've said that the seven largest companies that comprise the companies that are traded on the New York Stock Exchange, they are hugely influential, and they will gain more membership in the years ahead. Some of the smaller players are not going to fare well in this reformed world. But like I said, I think that the day will come when investors will decide that health insurance is not the best place for them to make a buck. And those big companies who comprise the cartel will be looking at other things to make money. They already are doing that. Cigna has a very big and growing international division. It sells supplemental products in many other countries around the world, including China. It was a big, big deal when Cigna was able to get a joint venture partner in China to be able to sell health supplemental health insurance policies. One thing that Cigna found out, they realized, is that things like cancer insurance sells very well in Asia. It's just something that's cultural, and they're taking advantage of that. In this country, many of these companies have always sold supplemental Medicare policies. And I think that may be where some of these companies will go. They'll look to see that they can make more money overseas, or they can become data management companies or health. Even you'll not see them call themselves insurance companies at all. Look on their websites. You will be hard-pressed to find the word insurance or managed care these days. They call themselves health services companies. So they are evolving, and they will eventually get out of the business, in my view, of providing basic health insurance. One of the things the new law does, it requires the creation of an essential benefits package that'll be the minimum that any insurance company can offer in this country. And so insurance will become more of a commodity. And you can't make a lot of money on something that is a commodity. You have to have some way of distinguishing yourself in the marketplace, or having some product that you can make more money on. And that's what's going to happen, in my view. I can't predict the future, but I can look back and see how these companies have changed their business models so drastically. And they're going to be doing it even at a greater clip, I think, in the years to come because of the legislation that was passed. Will we get a single payer to answer your question, or to get back to it? Possibly, but there are a lot of things that will have to happen. The insurance industry has been able to make people fear a single payer. They've gone about this every time there has been, yes, they call it socialism, that we would be going down to the slippery slope towards socialism, if we to use that term, or that it would represent a government takeover of the healthcare system. They want us to be afraid of that, and they want us to believe the lie that the Canadians don't like their healthcare system. One of the things I want to try to do is talk in ways that conservatives can understand. They have been so manipulated by the special interest. I want people to understand how they are misled and what goes into making sure that people are misled. Millions and millions of dollars are spent every year on these disinformation campaigns to achieve public policy objectives. And I've said this before, this is another reason why our system is so irrational. It is a system in which the people who need care the most can't get it. And people resort to lying on their applications because they otherwise can't get it. What kind of a system in the world where does that make sense? And then you'll hear the conservatives saying that we need to have more attention paid to reduce fraud and abuse in the system. Well, we have a lot of fraud in the system because of the system.
Why is health care in the U.S. so costly?
One of the reasons, there are a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons why we have the most expensive healthcare system in this world, because it has become more dominated by profit, for-profit companies in both the insurance and the provider side. The other dynamic that has happened is that the for-profit insurers, in particular, with their practices, especially during the managed care era, the way that they were implementing managed care plans really infuriated a lot of doctors, and it infuriated a lot of patients. So there was a huge backlash against these companies, and the insurers had to change the way they did business. They had to loosen some of the restrictions. They had to create broader networks, for example, of doctors. They could no longer get by with these very limited networks, and they had to be less ham-fisted in the way they dealt with individual doctors. But the other thing that happened was that because the insurance companies had the upper hand in bargaining with doctors and hospitals, we saw a consolidation on the provider side of hospitals having to consolidate or affiliate, and a lot of them convert to for-profit status. So it's almost cancerous what we have seen happen. The hospitals and doctors' practices had to do the things that they did to be able to stay in business, to make sure that they got enough money at the negotiating table to stay in business and thrive. And some have not done that. Some have gone under if they haven't been able to merge. I don't know what will happen to the for-profit hospitals. because they do make a lot of money. There's no doubt they make a lot of money. But that is one of the reasons. And I say some of our problems are largely intractable, and I think they have become intractable because of the profit motive in our healthcare system.
How do these corporate executives sleep at night?
The way they sleep at night is to make sure that they are far removed from the people who are suffering. And if I had not gone to Wise County, I swear I'd still be there probably doing the same thing. And I sometimes talk about how my CEO lived his life, and this is typical of CEOs. You have a driver, a company-paid driver, and who picks you up at your house in the morning in a company-financed car, drives you to your office, and you take the elevator to your fancy office. You don't even have to go to the cafeteria to mingle with your own employees. It's brought to your desk if you want to eat there. And for a long time, your premium's paid for his lunch, by the way. Cigna finally decided that after they had to disclose it on the proxy that they might make them start paying for their lunch. But then at the end of the day, the driver's got to take them back home. And if they have to go out of town, the driver takes them to the hangar, the private hangar where they get on the private jet to fly to a meeting. They never have to encounter people who need anything. And that becomes their life. It's in a cocoon. And you lose perspective when that happens. And then, of course, you want to make more money. There is never enough. You never make enough. You always want more. And you always have to satisfy Wall Street because that is your master. And it truly is a master. And then you rationalize that, well, my company does provide health care to 8 million or 10 million or 15 million or 30 million people. So those people are well served because we are making sure that they have health care coverage. You rationalize all the time. And you try to think that you're a good person because of what you do that may help someone. I did that. Sometimes when I was handling what we called high-profile cases in which the company had denied a treatment, coverage for a treatment or something like that, my job would be to explain to the executives the public relations consequences of sticking with the decision to deny coverage and the PR black eye the company would take if it kept on that path. And often the company would reverse a decision. And I would say, well, good for me. I helped that one person out. So that's how you get through the day, and that you drink a lot.
Do you think real change is possible?
Well, I do, and I think that there is a possibility. If we understand how they play the game, we're going to have to play the game based on their rules because they set the rules of the game. But we need to understand their playbook. We need to become more sophisticated. One of the reasons why the single-payer folks have never been able to achieve anything beyond just talk about it, is that they've never developed a real strategy for persuading people or countering the lies from the special interest. You need to think. The other thing I found, I guess it was, I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was, when I talked to the advocates of reform, I realized that most of those folks didn't come out of corporate America, and they don't have that discipline of developing strategies and business plans and meeting certain goals and being held accountable by somebody. You don't have that framework, but you need to have that framework, in my view, to advance a cause. And that's one of the things I hope to maybe try to bring forward for progressives to understand is this is what our opponents do. We've got to figure out how to do the same kind of thing. We've got to think strategically. We've got to develop alliances with organizations that may seem to be strange bedfellows, for example. There's a lot of things we can do. It's not a lost cause. There is the big thing that we have to do is change the way that we elect people and some of the lobbying and require a lot of transparency. The system right now is in place because the once these folks are elected, it is hard for them to resist the pressure from special interest. So you can be very much punished for telling the truth and doing the right thing in our political system. The money and the relationships that these big corporations have, they really rule. And one of the things that I don't think it's fear, I think it's reality. We essentially, in my view, have really lost our democracy. We have a plutocracy in this country, and I think we need to restore our democracy.
What can I do as a citizen?
Well, thank you, and I didn't plant that, but it's a perfect last question. Get informed and stay informed and stay active and do things that you might think are inconsequential, but when a lot of people are doing it, it makes a difference. Write letters to the editor of your newspaper or blog or post on Daily Kos or do whatever you can to make sure that your voice is out there. Call your member of Congress when there's something being debated that you're interested in and that's really important. Know that the special interests will do that. They'll be gearing up the robocalls, and their offices will be flooded with fake phone calls. So you've got to be out there and doing something all the time. Communicate with your insurance regulator. You've got to know who he or she is and the role that he or she plays. It's a lot of hard work, quite frankly, to be informed and to be active, but that's exactly what you got to do. Other than that, affiliate with a group and whatever it might be. I'm speaking to a lot of chapters of Physicians for National Healthcare, National Health Plan, Health Program. And, it's been around for 20 years. I hope more doctors will join that organization, and I hope more citizens will find other places to affiliate. And then talk to your conservative neighbors or your relatives in ways that can connect with them emotionally. One of my big criticisms of progressives is that we think we're so damn smart that if we can present the facts to someone, they're going to agree with us because they're the facts. That don't get it. You need to. The reason that the special interests have been able to get their way is that they can concoct these lies that and tell them in a way that scares people. It connects with them emotionally. And you've got to do that. You've got to make an emotional connection with people every bit as much, if not more, as more important than the intellectual connection. So get engaged and stay engaged. Thank you.
You were just listening to Wendell Potter on health insurance, an insane system. This classic from the AR archives was recorded at Powell's Bookstore in Portland, Oregon. Wendell Potter was a former Cigna public relations executive. Today, he's an outspoken critic of the health insurance industry. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Kuhan Pakmander, Stephen Bezruchka, Francesca Albanese, Naomi Klein, and Arundhati Roy. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Wendell Potter on Health Insurance, an Insane System, and for Ralph Nader's latest book, Let's Start the Revolution, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. Just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Will Singer. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with the tabla maestro Zakir Hussain and the Diga Rhythm Band performing Sweet 16.
You are listening to
The Sound of Language
on WRCT Pittsburgh, produced by the students in Contextual Practice Seminar. The views, thoughts, and opinions expressed in the show are solely those of individuals involved and do not necessarily express those of WRCT Pittsburgh or its members.
Hello to all of our Is Sound a Language listeners. This is Ashley.
The slogan.
Today we have a very special guest. We have Petra Floyd. They are a CMU School of Art MFA alumni and multidisciplinary visual and sound artist based in Pittsburgh, PA. We're super excited to be chatting with them this evening. How are you doing, Petra?
I'm okay. I feel like strangely nervous. I was like, wow, I feel like I'm interviewing for grad school again or something. Yeah. But yeah, otherwise, yeah, I feel good.
Amazing. So I wanted to start with a question that you gave us, actually, which is, what is your relationship to hearing and listening as a sense?
Yeah. When I wrote that question, I was thinking about how I'm drawn to working with sound because I have such a strong response to it. I'm someone who has like different sensory issues, something I didn't become more aware of until my adulthood. And so like hearing a slight buzz or things like that, right, would be affecting me emotionally, but I wouldn't know why. I'd be like a little annoyed or a little irritated or something, right? And then I found the word misophonia, and I forget what miso means in that, but phonio, as we know, it's like sound. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, things like someone chewing or having like a, not being able to clear their throat all the way, or honestly just not liking the sound of someone's voice. And be like, I wish I could change that. So that's a way that I became more aware of my relationship to sound as a sense. And I also do some grounding exercises, and you've probably heard this grounding exercise, the like 5, 4, 3, 2, 1 countdown, where it's like, name 5 things that you see, 4 things that you can touch, you know, things like that. And I was finding that that was helpful for me, because as someone who like doesn't drive, for example, I'd be like on the bus or the trolley in Philly, and it'd be like, man, I'm just so agitated and irritated on my commute to work. Like, why am I so angry? Like, yeah, work is hard, but like, this is just extra. And I realized it's because I couldn't control what was happening, like, sonically for me. even when you put in headphones, like someone's talking loud, you can hear the groan of the bus, like these different things. I'm talking about how sound, you know, can be a source of like concern for me, but also it's been a great comfort for me. And I would say that listening to a good like DJ set or sound podcast or something and going for a walk when I felt like my loneliness here in Pittsburgh as like a transplant was something that just refreshed my imagination, my outlook on life. And also there have been moments for me where sound has been transformative and I have just been like a weepy mess after like listening to something really good, you know? So those are some of the things that come to mind for me when thinking about sound as a sense and its impact on me.
And I guess to jump off about your relationship with sound and as a sense, do you consider sound a language?
Yeah, I was so curious about the name of this class and the name of this like podcast because, yeah, there's like lots of different languages. Not all of them are sonic, of course, like written language or like pictorial language. I think sound can be a language. When I think about a language, I think about like a coherent system of some sort that like you can refer to, even if it's just a language of your own, but you can refer back to it after the fact and there still be like a stable enough meaning, you know, that you're calling back to. So yeah, sound can be a language. It kind of feels silly to like be like, can sound be a language when we're literally speaking right now?
Yeah.
But I'm just thinking like, I think about the patterns of life, like waiting at the bus stop, hearing the cars whiz by, hearing two blocks away the sound of the bus beeping, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the bus comes, the doors open, it lowers, you know? There's a beep of me tapping my car. That's a predictable pattern that communicates that I'm on some type of journey. Mm. So, yeah, why not? Sure.
Well, it reminds me of when, I don't know if you had this experience as a kid, but whenever you're making like an imaginary language or something and there has to be someone else to exchange it with and have a kind of call and response, like the bus in a way becomes that. So you're an artist who makes sound, improvisational performance. How important to you is the act of improvisation and does it have to be recorded? Does it have to have a life outside of that moment? Or is the kind of special quality of it that it's ephemeral and lives on in those that participated in it?
I mean, I think there can be benefits to recording and also not recording. For example, I went to an improv set last night. There's this really wonderful group called Pittsburgh Sound Preserve. They've run Open Improv Lab, which has been a really important space for me where, as the name suggests, we improvise. And it's kind of random who you end up improvising with, although there's like a cast of recurring characters, which I'm glad to become one. And I, in the past, have taken out my phone to record. Where I'm like, ooh, this moment is really hitting. Like, I need to capture it, maybe because my partner is in a particular improv group and I want them to hear back what happens, you know? And in that type of setting, it can be nice to record because sometimes when you're really like catching the spirit and you're just sort of riding the wave, right? Because you're really plugged in. You're listening to the audience and your collaborators. So it's nice to have something to be like, oh yes, that moment happened. Yeah. Because sometimes I improv with people and I forget who I even improv with. They'll be like, yeah, that was great. And I was like, So it's nice to have the document in that kind of way for an open improv like that. But last night I just was like, I don't want to record. I want to just be in the moment. You know, also, I will say, though, it depends on your goals, right? If you want a type of score for yourself to refer back to because you're creating a work or something, then that's great. You can use it to sample, bring it into the next improvisation. But I don't necessarily always have the patience to like go back and listen to the recording. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So a few weeks ago, we did an exercise where we thought of either like the first song that we could remember and tried to like locate where it takes us. And so we're curious if there's a sound or a piece of music that you can recall and like where it takes you.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many songs that do that for me, that send me into a specific place. I will say that there's this one DJ producer named African Sciences. It's African spelled with a K. And he has this one mix. It's called, he did it for Berlin Community Radio, I believe. And the mix is called Satellite Editions
1.
And well, let's say I took a bath and it was an enhanced bath. And I was listening to, you know, this set before. It helped inspire some artwork I made. It helped me work through a problem I had. Mm-hmm. And then for this enhanced bath, I was listening to it and I connected with my ancestors and they had some important things to tell me about myself. Physical space that African Sciences constructed for me, when I listen back to it, it's an opportunity to return back to those lessons, that self-knowledge discovered in those moments. I offer that to y'all if you want to listen to something really groovy and good. I will say that sometimes being a person, there's so many different parts of you that you become alienated from or are influenced to think are separate and discrete. And when you're in the practice of making sense of yourself, like in grad school, and presenting that to other people, there's lots of self-editing that happens for me before I even knew it. And something like an African Sciences set is like, no, all of those things, no matter how disparate they seem, even they don't fit neatly into the outline or the brainstorming map or whatever, like this is like the universe of you. These are, you know, these are the various constellations that inform you, and they can all be in the same place. So really impactful music does that for me.
Amazing. Wow. I think talking about graduate school and that experience, a few of us in the program have had a lot of conversations about play and what play means. And